The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you could take a pill right now that would enhance your concentration, increase your productivity, and reduce your stress levels, would you do it? What if everyone else at your workplace were taking these pills? Would that sway your decision? Drugs traditionally prescribed for patients with ADHD to treatments for narcolepsy are already popular as study aids for college students. Now, nootropics or smart drugs are on the rise by American workers looking to enhance their cognitive abilities. Carl Cederstrom is an associate professor at Stockholm University and co-author of The Wellness Syndrome. He wrote about the ethical dilemmas surrounding the growing use of smart drugs for the Harvard Business Review and joins us now via Skype. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Now, in your article, you cite that nearly one in five Ivy League college students report taking brain-boosting drugs, many off-label, meaning they're not prescribed for them for a particular condition. How do people typically obtain these drugs?
If we look at the industry of these medications, it's huge. I mean, the number of drugs for ADHD is massive, and a lot of people do have the diagnosis, they do have prescriptions, and for college students obtaining these drugs is not very difficult. Usually they would know someone or they would have people around them who would either give them or sell them. And if that is not an option, there are also ways of obtaining these drugs over the internet.
What are some of the benefits, either real or perceived, of using smart drugs?
I think the drug that has been most discussed and at the center of a lot of these the controversy about using these drugs is one called modafinil, which was originally designed to combat narcolepsy. The studies that we've seen so far suggest that taking these drugs, especially under sleep-deprived conditions, may help people to make better decisions and be better at planning. This is what these meta-analysis that people have done recently. There was particularly one study that was co-authored by, it was a Harvard-Oxford study, schools working together and finding that these were some of the benefits that could be noticed when people were using these drugs.
And narcolepsy is, of course, when people fall asleep. So this keeps them from falling asleep.
That's right. So this is something that is originally designed for people with something which is making their life very difficult on an everyday basis. Of course, falling asleep is something that will make your life very difficult. But it could also be used, it turns out, for people without narcolepsy and still having some of the benefits in terms of removing tiredness or making people better at concentrating, even when they are tired.
Can we compare the effects of these drugs, modafinil and also ADHD drugs like Ritalin or Adderall, to other substances that people do use without a prescription, you know, maybe a coffee drink or an energy drink, you know, a double espresso? Is this just a step up?
That is what a lot of people would say. And I should stress that I'm not an expert in the medical part of this thing. I mean, I think what I find most interesting and striking with the use of these drugs, whether coffee or more advanced drugs, is the extent to which people are trying to make themselves more productive and using whatever means and whatever techniques are available.
Well, it sounds like better planning, more creative, less impulsive. Those are some of the effects. Are qualities that management would embrace or even encourage. Now, universities have faced this question. Is this cheating?
Yeah, I mean, that's the very core of this moral dilemma. And I think that if you take all of the wellness programs that you're now finding corporations, they are designed to make people feel better, to make them healthier, but also to make people more productive and making sure that they are so healthy that they can work for long hours and without getting ill. If that is what we're trying to do in the workplace when we're studying, then where do we draw the line between what kind of methods we're using? So I think that to understand the emergence of these drugs, it's not enough just looking at the medicines as such, but rather also looking at the atmosphere that a lot of students are facing, where it's a great pressure to make sure you get the best grades. And also if you work in a corporation, you have a lot of pressure to deliver.
Well, I'm imagining that, when somebody gets a lackluster performance review, a manager might suggest drugs. I mean, I don't want to have to take drugs to perform as well as others at work. But the pressure to up the game to get the next best performance-enhancing drug would be on, especially in competitive workforces.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the heart of this matter, because a lot of corporations would already have doctors. And, part of the reason why they are there is to limit the cost of health insurance. It's also about making people so healthy that they could work and be productive. And of course, we would have no objections to that because, we want to be healthy and we want to feel good. And if that allows us to be more productive, great. But then if we do have these other methods, these other techniques, whether medications or other forms of technologies, where we go from just being healthy and work well to becoming very, very healthy and being able to produce even better, would we then want to take that step? So I think that is the moral dilemma. The moral dilemma is not so much cheating or not, because if you think about it, we cheat all the time. Being born into a family which is making great investment in your education as a child is a form of cheating, in the sense that you are then going to have a huge advantage over other kids. And all of the other productivity techniques we're using all of the time, again, with the intention of making ourselves more productive. So cheating is not really the issue. I think that is kind of diverting the attention away from the real issue, which here is how far are we willing to go in making ourselves more competitive as employees or as students or, whatever kind of person we are.
Any problems with using the drugs off-label without doctor supervision that users may not be aware of, maybe other drug interactions that you know of?
Well, again, I mean, I'm not an expert in the field of medicine, and I would not recommend anyone to use these drugs, of course, without consulting a doctor. I've made interviews with about 10 people so far using these drugs, and I've been quite surprised by how aware they are about the effects and how they are being integrated into their everyday life. I think one assumption we have about the use of these drugs is that students are using them to stay awake for one night, maybe two nights, and work really, really hard. What I found speaking to these people is that a lot of them are integrating the use of these drugs into what seems as a very conscious and a very healthy lifestyle, waking up early in the morning, making sure to eat correctly, then going to the gym, and then working a lot and trying to make that in as an effective way as you can, and using the drugs together with this. So this was something which I found really surprising, because usually when you think about using drugs, off-label drugs like these, and all of the people I've interviewed are technically doing something illegal, they nevertheless do this in a very conscientious way. So that is something which I find really surprising and kind of difficult to get your head around, the drug use, which is a form of, I wouldn't say maybe conformism, but it's a way of trying to make yourself fit better in with the ideals and pressures of modern society.
Well, and also, as you suggest, may widen the gap between those people already in a place of privilege within an organization or within society and those struggling to keep up.
Yeah, I mean, that's another interesting debate. I mean, the people I've interviewed for the research I'm doing at the moment, they come from privileged backgrounds. Many of them have been to very prestigious universities. But you also have parallel debate to this, which is very interesting, and that relates to medical doctors who are giving these types of drugs, Adderall in particular, which is an ADHD medication, to children who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And there was a very interesting interview with one of these doctors a while back when he explained that he gives these medications to children without necessarily having ADHD. But what they do have, which is a great disadvantage, is that they are being born into families where it may be very difficult to find the peace and quiet to do your studies. It may be that they are having a social situation which makes it very difficult for them to succeed in life. And what one of these medical doctors said in the interview was that we don't necessarily know what the long-term effects will be of using these drugs, but we do know what the short-term effects are in terms of lagging behind in your schoolwork, getting poor results in school. That means that almost immediately that you will be pushed aside, you will fall behind, and the disadvantages that you will get from those sort of early mistakes in life may be impossible to repair later on. So you've seen people who've been prescribing these forms of drugs to the people who are most disadvantaged in an attempt to help them out, which is another form of very, I would say, morally and ethically difficult debate.
How open are people about using brain boosters at work?
So, I mean, I've had no difficulties finding people to talk about the use of these drugs on a personal level. But of all the people I've been speaking to so far, so it's about 10 people who I met in person and speaking to, and then another maybe 10 and 20, which I've been corresponding with. They all seem to be relatively open about the use of the drugs. They're willing to talk about it, but they all keep it away from their boss, which is a very interesting thing if you think about it, because you could argue that, you know, they do this in order to be better workers. I mean, it's something that in some ways the boss should be quite pleased about, but then at the same time they know that it will be information which will be very difficult to deal with. I mean, in Sweden, for instance, if it turns out that someone is using, you know, drugs, the first thing they need to do is to make an investigation to see how serious this drug use is and send them off to rehab or whatever. But what happens when someone is using drugs which is not affecting work negatively, but using the drugs affecting the work positively, then we are facing another set of dilemmas. I still haven't found executives who are aware of these things taking place in their workplace and willing to talk about it. But I still hope that some people in that position would be willing to step forward, because I think that would be an interesting people to talk about.
Well, Carl, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Carl Cederstrom, he's Associate Professor of Organization Theory at Stockholm University and co-author of The Wellness Syndrome. We have a link to read his article from the Harvard Business Review. It's called Like It or Not, Smart Drugs Are Coming to the Office. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. No creature has captured the human imagination quite like the king of the dinosaurs, Tyrannosaurus rex. The giant lizard dominates natural history museum halls. Artists and CGI film teams present T-Rex as an enormous, powerful lizard, sprinting, tiny arms flailing, gaping mouth, exposing an artillery of sharp teeth, and of course, its menacing trademark roar. But what if we got all that wrong? What if the mighty beast sounded a lot more like this? Ben Guarino is staff writer for The Washington Post, where he wrote about new findings that real dinosaurs sounded a lot, what,
wimpier,
Ben? Wimpier than the ones in Jurassic Park. So what did the T-Rex, king of all dinosaurs, really sound like?
So, you know, we can't say with perfect accuracy exactly what it sounded like, but we have some pretty good ideas. And based off of some of our best estimates, they sounded like these birds that are able to coo and bellow and hoot.
Like?
Well, so there are ostriches that fill their throat sacs up, and they have these strange sort of cooing sounds. But some of the crocodiles, too, have these really impressive, they're low bellows, but they're not these big, savage, Chewbacca-like roars that Steven Spielberg is so fond of.
Well, this is all new research from University of Texas biologists, if I have it right. How did they determine this?
Yeah, so in order to get a sense of what dinosaurs sound like, what we can do is, and what the scientists at the University of Texas at Austin and some of their other colleagues, they looked at birds and crocodiles. Now, there's some compelling genetic research that says that these birds and these crocodilians are the closest living relatives of Tyrannosaurus and all of these big famous dinosaurs that we know. So using the sounds that these birds and the crocodiles made, they went through and they looked at all the different sounds that these animals could make. Now, the birds with the biggest bodies and all of the crocodilians made what's called a closed mouth sound. So they kept their mouths closed as they made the sound. But what they did was they inflated their throat sacs, if they had them, or they kind of vibrated in their chests. And it made this really low sort of bass bellow, or in the case of like a pigeon, a sort of coo, maybe a little bit wimpier than what we would have imagined.
So closed mouth. You know, where did this iconic, you know, head lurching forward, fabricated roar of the T-Rex come from?
You know, I have to imagine that it was just some sound guy who figured, you know, we have this idea of these giant, massive beasts, and you think of lions roaring, and you think of, you know, all of these top predators that we associate with these terrifying sounds. So if you go back through some of the history of the first dinosaur movies, even Godzilla, I know he's not a dinosaur, but he has this really iconic primal scream. And I think that just sort of stuck in our minds, in our cultural consciousness. If you start to look at birds, and now we know that birds are pretty closely related to dinosaurs, you don't really see those great roars.
So what else has Hollywood and CGI teams misled us with about dinosaurs?
So I don't know if they misled us from the beginning, but right around when Jurassic Park was first made, and in the time since then, we've sort of increasingly got this sense that some of the dinosaurs and some of our iconic dinosaurs might have had feathers. Now, there's some debate about whether or not T-Rex had feathers, but they think maybe when T-Rex was young, right after he hatched, and these juvenile T-Rexes might have even had some what they call proto-feathers. So they're not perfectly like what we think of chicken feathers, but they're pretty darn close. So there's an idea that, you know, even velociraptors were really covered in a lot of different feathers and things like that.
So first we learned dinosaurs covered in feathers. Now they close their mouths when they call and sound like doves or ostriches. So are dinosaurs, this stuff of childhood obsessions and so many books and pajamas, are they in any danger of losing their allure?
Personally, I don't think so. I think this idea of a 15-foot feathery creature that bellows like a crocodile is still pretty terrifying and still captures our imagination. It might even look, I don't know, almost more exotic and awe-inspiring than some sort of scaly, pebbly, lizard-like thing.
Well, Ben, thank you for, enlightening us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Ben Guarino, he's a staff writer for The Washington Post, and you'll find a link to his piece, Think Dinosaurs Roared Like in Jurassic Park? The truth, new research says, is a bit wimpier. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, our understanding of how dinosaurs looked and sounded may have evolved since Spielberg's mega blockbuster Jurassic Park. But if you head to your local library, you're sure to discover a lot of children's books that still feature the scaly reptilian dinosaurs of yore. Sure, some of them are just old, but even contemporary illustrators are sticking with outdated science, despite evidence to the contrary. Children's book illustrator Scott Hartman, one of those willing to put feathers on a velociraptor, explains why.
Obviously, there's going to be some mental inertia. I mean, dinosaur still is a euphemism for the thing that's out of date, waiting to go extinct, right? So in part of it, I think we might even have a cultural mental block. And at other times, I think there might just genuinely be that people involved don't know. You don't have to pass a specific qualification to write and publish a book. You just have to be good at making and publishing books. So in some cases, they might literally just not be aware of the data.
Whether or not this is a problem up for debate. On the one hand, dinosaurs have long slipped off the leash of nonfiction and taken on a mythic quality that has little to do with true paleontology. But dinosaurs are also an entry point for young, science-oriented kids who are interested in fossils partly because dinosaurs are not fiction. And by that logic, aren't we missing an educational opportunity when we promote outdated science in picture books?
When we sit around and lament the state of education in our country, you know, maybe there's some looking in the mirror for, like, both promoting and or accepting things that we know are out of date. being out there for sale. But again, there's no obviously single regulatory body responsible for that. There's no, you know, paleo police outside of perhaps on internet chat boards.
Well, internet chat boards aside, there are at least a few kids' books that are not afraid of feathered dinos. Scott Hartman's own ABC Dinosaurs is a good one. There is also a very direct Boy, Were We Wrong About Dinosaurs by Kathleen Kudlinski. Or if you're looking for a book that's both feathered and fictional, how about George O'Connor's If I Had a Raptor? It is not exactly accurate, but one thing is for sure, the author is not living in the past. Seeing is believing, they say. One explanation why science deniers push back against phenomena like climate change or evolution, which may not be obvious on a day-to-day basis or visible to the naked eye. Regardless, there is one anti-science conspiracy theory that's made headlines recently, one that even the most ardent climate change deniers may have trouble accepting. Levi Sharp has the story.
If you passed Jonathan Vincent on the street, you would probably walk by without noticing him. He's a detailer for a luxury car company and looks like your average middle-class guy with stubble, wearing a baseball cap and worn-out jeans. But I was actually looking for Jonathan Vincent because he heads a meetup of people who believe the Earth is flat.
I've unfortunately come to the realization that everything we know and think we know about society, the government, has been completely false, completely falsified.
We met outside of the Chit Chat Diner in Hackensack, New Jersey, where he had his first meetup.
The intent of the group was to find, I guess, root out any possible flat Earth believers, kind of reduce the isolation factor for believing in something this eccentric.
So far, he's brought together 12 flat earthers, including himself, and they create a complex framework to hold onto this one belief. To Jonathan, the Earth looks like a flat disk, well,
Antarctica would be the ring that sits around and holds the water in.
Because, of course, if there wasn't some sort of a wall, the water would fall off the world. As for why we have night and day and seasons,
the sun and the moon travel chasing each other kind of around a flat disk.
As for lunar eclipses, many flat earthers think that instead of the Earth casting a shadow onto the moon, there's an invisible anti-moon which blocks the non-invisible moon. How something invisible casts a shadow, I'm still not sure. And gravity, you ask? Some flat earthers believe that the Earth is accelerating upwards, much like an elevator, and this is what pushes everything down. But Jonathan says this is a purposefully bad argument put out by non-flat earthers to spew out
garbage, stuff that doesn't make sense, to make the flat Earth believer look crazy.
He prefers to believe that the Earth is just a giant flat magnet that pulls us down. This entire flat Earth ideology is connected to Jonathan's belief of a giant conspiracy that a powerful elite is orchestrating a mass deception to hide an abundance of natural resources. Jonathan believes in other conspiracy theories, too.
There's proof that evolution is completely wrong, that there's never been a change of kind in terms of species. The Sandy Hook shooting, Charleston shooting, the one in Washington, under a critical eye, they fall apart. There's so many holes, so many there. State that again. No one has been to the moon.
But out of all these conspiracies, for Jonathan, the deception that the Earth isn't flat is the biggest con of them all. And there are a shocking number of people who believe the same thing as him. The Flat Earth Society, a website dedicated to disseminating flat Earth doctrine, has a forum with over 8,600 members, and their Facebook page has over 18,000 likes. And flat earthers aren't limited to people you'd pass by without noticing. A popular rapper named B.O.B. came out as a flat earther on Twitter and went on a rant about his beliefs. His views reached so many people that Neil deGrasse Tyson felt the need to shut him down. Their online spat spilled over into tabloid news.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is over B.O.B.'s flat earth theories. The rapper's tweet supporting a conspiracy theory about the earth being flat went viral, only for America's favorite celebrity physicist to correct B.O.B.'s misconception.
After the Twitter spat with Tyson, B.O.B. then came out with a song called Flatline.
Neil Tyson need to loosen up his vest. They probably write that man one hell of a check. Hey,
and Tyson responded by taking the fight to The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore on Comedy Central.
Isaac Newton, my man, said, if I have seen farther than others, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Yeah. I get an amen. So that's right, B.O.B. When you stand on the shoulders of those who came before, you might just see far enough to realize the Earth isn't flat. And by the way, this is called gravity.
That, at the end there, was Tyson dropping the mic. It's easy to think that people like flat earthers, those who believe in giant conspiracies, are silly. It's tempting to just drop the mic and walk away from them. But then you're walking away from a lot of people. Research shows half of all Americans believe in at least one conspiracy theory.
Given the number of people who believe in conspiracy theories, it's probably unlikely that all of them are suffering from some kind of psychopathology.
Veeran Swamy is a professor of social psychology at Anglia Ruskin University in the UK. He's done a ton of research about conspiracy theorists, including flat earthers.
One of the strongest predictors of whether you will accept a new conspiracy theory, like, for example, the flat earth idea, is your pre-existing belief in a conspiracy theory. So someone who already believes, say, for example, in a 9/11 conspiracy theory is much more likely to accept the flat earth conspiracy theory because it fits into their worldview that there are people who are manipulating and doing bad things.
Swamy says the most plausible reason people believe in conspiracy theories has to do with stress and empowerment. When some kind of stressful event happens, such as a terrorist attack, or even when someone feels helpless in their life situation, they have a need to make sense of why these things are happening.
People who lack agency or lack power in some way are much more likely to accept a conspiracy theory because it gives them a sense of agency. If, for example, you can personify the threat, now you can challenge them. Now you can go on Twitter and have a rant about it.
For Jonathan Vincent, the Earth being round is just not something he can accept. And when I spoke to him, I could hear that need that Swamy was talking about. Jonathan believes in what is called the firmament, which harkens back to the Bible. Flat earthers interpret it as an invisible dome around the Earth.
And it says that we're perfect inside of this thing and that we are the center of the universe. This whole idea of us being a speck of dust floating through space, just an insignificant accident, is nothing anyone would ever tell to their kids. You know, like, hey, Johnny, you know, just want to let you know you're just an accident, so get out there and win today. It doesn't feel right, and it doesn't seem right.
I asked Jonathan what it would take to convince him that the Earth isn't flat.
What about, I guess, just going up in an airplane really high? Like, you can also see that curvature. And also, I mean, like, every pilot would have to be in on this deception.
The first thing you learn in school is 1 + 1 = 2, and we're living on this ball. So when you look out of a plane window, psychologically, your brain's going to make up for that. If you see level, it's going to tell you it's curved, even the slightest bit. I might even fall victim to that.
I spent more than an hour with Jonathan, going back and forth like this. I tried to poke holes in his flat earth theory, and it didn't make a difference.
How do you feel about how other people perceive you, and maybe would even say that these kinds of conspiracy beliefs are psychological...
aberrations?
Yeah, something like that.
Anyone who says that they don't care about what other people think of them is full of it, because we all care about what other people, and you should care about what other people think of you. You shouldn't care as much to start changing the way you are.
Even though Jonathan is unwavering in his beliefs, Veeran Swamy hopes that the more we talk about conspiracy theories and point out why they are scientifically implausible, the more people will stop believing them. In New Jersey, I'm Levi Sharp.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the aftermath of the Great Depression, the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, commissioned hundreds of people to interview Americans and record their stories as part of the Federal Writers Project. In the 1930s, many of those interviews had been slaves. They and others remembered life in the South under slavery and the dawn of the Jim Crow South which followed. The WPA collection remains one of the largest surviving collections of first-person testimony on slavery. Yet the circumstances under which the interviews were collected gives many researchers pause and prompted Rebecca Onion to ask about the role that racism played. Rebecca is Slate staff writer covering new historical research, and she wrote about the collection of slave narratives for Slate. Rebecca, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Could you give us some background on why these narratives were even being collected as part of the WPA project?
Well, there was a sort of a push to collect folklore in general and sort of testimonies about life in the South. And so on one level, one of the things that people within the WPA, the Federal Writers Project, were trying to do was to sort of catalog American life. So there was a series of guidebooks to different American states, you know, the kind of food that was popular there, where you could go, these kinds of things. So sort of like a patriotic approach to describing American life and writing about it. And so they'd tap unemployed writers and artists to sort of carry out these projects. And that way, interviewing ex-slaves fit into that kind of project.
So this is a huge volume, 2,300 oral histories of elderly ex-slaves, but not considered to be sound research by all scholars. Why not?
It's been a matter of debate among historians, and I'd say it's still a really active debate. And I should say that the main sort of book that I'm looking at in this piece is written by a historian named Catherine Stewart, and the book is called Long Past Slavery. And she's sort of intervening in this longstanding debate among historians about how much we can sort of trust or rely on these narratives for actual stories of the history of slavery. And the main point of debate has been that a lot of the interviewers that were carrying out these interviews were not only white, but also in some cases, descendants of the same slaveholders that had held those interviewees, or active members of the Daughters of the Confederacy. So at the time that interviews were being carried out, there was sort of resurgence of this idea of the lost cause. So in the same decade, the Gone with the Wind movie came out and people really loved it. This idea that, you know, the Confederacy was sort of like a romantic, doomed endeavor that, you know, people sort of really like to romanticize. And some of the interviewers were sort of participating in the same set of ideological concepts. And so they went into the interviews sort of looking for, you know, expressions of fealty from the ex-slaves, you know, oh, this wasn't so bad. My slaveholder was good to me. He didn't beat me, these kinds of things. And so these expectations in some cases did translate into the ex-slaves sort of partially giving the interviewers what they wanted. And so that sort of situation has long caused historians to wonder. We have to read between the lines, basically.
Well, some of the interviewers were African-American, including quite famously Zora Neale Hurston. So do you think those who were in charge of the project were conscious that they may get different answers? I mean, was that even part of the thinking then?
Well, I mean, it was all sort of tainted by the racism of the era. What I really love about Catherine Stewart's book is that she looks at the way the interviews were commissioned and edited. So she's looking at the production process, you know, the drafts that go back and forth between people at the state level who are editing, people at the federal level who are sort of asking for more and more. And she finds that some of the editors, you know, the sort of the white editors who were maybe a little bit more sort of aligned with this lost cause ideology, a little bit more sort of fixated on drawing out these particular kind of reminiscences that would put the Confederacy in a good light, did ask, we don't want to hear as much about cruelty. We want to hear more about folklore. We want to hear about, you know, ghost stories or the kinds of everyday life things that people did on the plantation that are like a little bit more colorful, kind of less controversial. And on the other hand, the Black interviewers and the Black editors would sort of manage to get these stories of cruelty, of whippings, stories about how happy and excited enslaved people were when emancipation came, these kinds of tales that were not as kind to the Confederacy. They did manage to sneak some of those in.
Can you give us some specific examples of how these interviews kind of ran or how those conducted by white writers as opposed to African-American writers might differ?
There would be, with some of these white interviewers, and I don't want to, you know, say every single one was this way, but maybe especially with the ones that Catherine Stewart looks at who were Daughters of the Confederacy and sort of allied to this idea, there would be a sort of an underlying concept of the interviewee as sort of funny or humorous or guileless or sort of like an object of fun in this way that people were really used to at that time from reading stories like the Uncle Remus stories or some of the plantation fiction that had Black people, you know, slaves as sort of these funny, like humorous characters. And so the way that the white interviewer might sort of enter the person's home, there was much less sort of consideration of the interviewee as sort of a dignified person mm-hmm. who might have something really concrete to say.
We're speaking with Rebecca Onion, who writes for Slate, about the WPA's collection of narratives from former slaves. This is a huge body of work, but also one tainted, as so many parts of American historical research are, and American history, by racism. So we get this picture from these narratives of, as you mentioned, you know, the sort of grand, glorified South when things were peaceful and happy, but also post-Civil War America. I mean, there was a lot of transformation going on in American history in the 20s and 30s. How was that reflected in these slave narratives?
Doing research for this piece, I read a really interesting article by another historian who wrote that she thought the WPA narratives were sort of most... not most telling, but she thought they were a sort of an underutilized source for understanding how elderly Black people in the South were weathering the Depression. So she would look at the WPA narratives for instances of the descriptions of poverty and or, you know, sort of descriptions that the people would give about how they were, you know, relying on their family, or maybe their family had migrated so they couldn't rely on them, the sort of interactions they had with the government, you know, in relationship to getting relief or getting, you know, some kind of payment or food support. So there's a lot of sort of, if you're not talking necessarily about the times of slavery, which granted is sort of what a lot of maybe especially the white WPA writers wanted to focus on, there's a lot of sort of ways to read these narratives to find out what it was like to be usually impoverished Black person in Jim Crow South and to be elderly and to not have much support.
But there was also some sense of mourning for those who'd moved north during the Great Migration. You know, the quote unquote, the old time Negro is passing on. What was behind that?
Yes. Well, so this is what you're referring to is a sort of a from the early 20th century until, you know, the 1930s and 1940s. This is a sense of nostalgia on the part of white people, I should say, for a perceived past when the racial order was, you know, maybe more comprehensible to them or made more sense or whatever it was. And it sort of came out in these expressions of sadness that, you know, an older kind of, well, they would say Negro was no longer to be found in the South. And as you say, this is related to the Great Migration. You know, there's a economic loss for white landholders in the South when a lot of the labor starts going north. So that's sort of underlying it in a way, but it gets expressed in this way where it comes out as white writers saying, you know, we're just losing so much in terms of folklore, in terms of the old stories, in terms of the old ways, when in reality, it's also, you know, a deeply political thing to say.
You know, this methodology has been questioned for some time, but how about today, Rebecca? I mean, when differences between racial perspectives is so often acute, do white interviewers get a different story than African-American interviewers?
That is a huge question. I would have to guess yes. I mean, I don't know what data set I would use to answer that. You'd have to do sort of a careful analysis the same way that Catherine Stewart has done here to find that out. One thing that really resonated with me in her book that had to do with the idea of, they used to call it a Negro bias, this idea among some of the white editors or the white controllers of this project that the Black interviewers and the Black interviewees could not be trusted to produce some kind of truth because they were sort of inherently biased towards their own race or they were overly emotional or whatever it was. And it really resonated with me because of a month and a half ago, Donald Trump coming out and saying, you know, I don't believe that the judge in my Trump University case can judge my case correctly because he has Hispanic heritage, which kind of taps this really, really old idea about bias and testimony.
Well, there are several examples in your article that you pull from Catherine Stewart's book about the differences in the kind of answers that the African-American and the white interviewers got. One of them really struck me. This is about emancipation specifically. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I think it was a pair of interviewees, Sam and Louisa Everett.
Yes, a married couple, the Everetts, who were interviewed by Pearl Randolph. And you can hear, actually, in the excerpt that I'm about to read, the sort of the way that Randolph wrote up their testimony, which is in third person and again, like a sort of academic English. And so the Everetts told Randolph about the reaction that their slaveholder had when news of emancipation came to the plantation, where there still were a number of people being held in bondage, despite being pretty late in the war. And basically, they reported to Randolph that Big Jim kind of went off the rails. So Randolph writes, Big Jim stood weeping on the piazza and cursing the fate that had been so cruel to him by robbing him of all of his, well, he uses an objectionable term, and words. He inquired if any wanted to remain until all the crops were harvested, and when no one consented to do so, he flew into a rage. Seizing his pistol, he began firing into the crowd of frightened Negroes. Some were killed outright, and others were maimed for life. Finally, he was prevailed upon to stop. He then attempted to take his own life. So there's this persistent myth in Lost Cause ideology that at emancipation, a number of ex-slaves just stayed on the plantation because they were so loyal and they just loved their situation so much that they didn't want to leave. And a story like this highlights a couple of things, one of which is the volatility of that situation, where the people who'd just been emancipated had so little protection. They had each other, but who else might be there to, help them deal with this situation where the person who's had so much control over their lives has just basically gone completely out of control and, started killing some of them. And so the Randolphs say later on in their narrative, some of the ex-slaves basically persuaded him to stop by saying, okay, we'll stay. And so this sort of gives this counter story to what the prevailing white story was about emancipation, which is to say, this was a really dangerous time and things happened that, might not ever have been reported if it wasn't for someone interviewing people who had been there to see it.
Yeah, pretty powerful stuff. Rebecca, just an absolutely illuminating article. Thank you so much for speaking with us about it.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Rebecca Onion is a Slate staff writer covering new historical research, and that's where she wrote about the WPA's collection of narratives from former slaves. You can find a link to read that article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org, as well as a link to the History of American Slavery podcast series that Rebecca hosted with Jamel Bowie. All that, again, wordofmouthradio.org. Our last word today comes from the Daily Dot, reporting that pornography traffic in Cleveland during the Republican National Convention last week surged by 184%. And for the sake of good taste, we are not going to report on the most popular search terms, which were tracked by another service called Pornhub. It's a convention. Nobody's judging what you do in your hotel room. And we know that this is not a horse race. But aren't you just a little bit curious to see similar data after the DNC wraps in Philly this week? Let's hear your predictions. What kind of activity do you think is going to spike during the DNC? Equal adult viewership? Maybe searches for interpreting economic indicators, how to recycle balloons, or vegan substitutes for Philly cheesesteak. Let us know. We're Word of Mouth on Facebook and at Word of Mouth on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with more Word of Mouth, always on the search, tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.